From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The Norwegian Academy of Science and Letters this week announced the winners of the 2018 Kavli Prizes. Now, the Kavlis are only a decade old, and they don't enjoy the same name recognition as the Nobels, but these are prestigious $1 million prizes that recognize some of the most important advances in three different areas: nanoscience, neuroscience, and astrophysics. Joining me now with an overview of those and other science headlines is Anna Nagel. She's chief editor for digital and engagement with the journal Nature. Anna, the Kavli Prizes this year, let's start with nanoscience, went to two people who I think many would recognize as being involved in the development of a gene editing tool called CRISPR, and then also to a third scientist that is relatively unknown. How surprising was it that he got recognized as well?
So, yes, this is an interesting one. The Nanoscience Prize went to, as you said, two familiar names, Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna. The third scientist who won the prize, and forgive me for my pronunciation, was Virginijus Šikšnis, who's a Lithuanian researcher who's also been working on the gene editing technology, but as you say, hasn't received quite as much media and mainstream attention as the other two researchers and another name, Feng Zhang, who's also a big name in CRISPR. Among the community, he is still a well-known CRISPR researcher. So within the CRISPR field, it's not a surprise that he was awarded the prize. But yeah, he's been definitely not as much in the headlines as the others.
The prize for neuroscience actually went to some understanding of hair cells in our ears and basically the neuroscience of how hearing works. And then the final prize, astrophysics, went to research on the birth and life cycle of stars. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Yeah, so that went to Evina van der Schuk, and she is the one of the three prizes. She's the one who got the whole prize to herself for astrophysics. The other two prizes were both shared between three people. And yes, she got it for revealing the chemical and physical processes involved in the formation of stars and planets.
Pretty cool stuff. But one of the neat things or interesting things to note about this winner list this year is seven people, four females and three men. That's pretty unusual in the top levels of prizes. Certainly, if you were looking at the Nobels, you don't see that kind of distribution.
Absolutely. One of the things that we write quite a lot about is gender disparity in science. So it is nice to see a lot of female representation among those top prizes.
All right, moving on to some other headlines, because, of course, not all science wins a Kavli every year, but there's lots of other interesting stuff. There's a story you've had in Nature recently about deep learning, kind of artificial intelligence, being able to mimic the way that our brain finds our way and navigates through space. What happened here that surprised researchers so much?
So this is really fascinating work. So in this research, some neuroscientists teamed up with artificial intelligence researchers from a company called DeepMind, which is owned by Google. You might be familiar with it. Mm-hmm. And they made an AI algorithm that's managed to recreate some of the brain's inner GPS system.
And this is actually research, this inner GPS system, something called grid cells, that did win a Nobel Prize a couple of years ago. And one of the scientists, Edvard Moser, who won the Nobel Prize for understanding this process in the brain, you have a quote in that piece in Nature saying, you know, this is really exciting and kind of took us all by surprise.
Mm. So what they found interesting was, so they were interested in investigating grid cells, which is the part of that GPS system that we think helps us track our position within space and calculate how to move between places. So the researchers created this algorithm to test that idea. They kind of trained it up and then they sort of set it a challenge. And what really surprised them was that the AI spontaneously generated patterns of activity that were really similar to how grid cells behave in the brain. And in some measures, in some tasks, it was so good that when they set it on a maze-based task, it worked out how to take shortcuts. And it even beat a professional games player when they set it these challenges. So that's really surprising and exciting.
And I have to say, anytime that artificial intelligence surprises us, it's interesting. It's also maybe a little bit scary.
Well, what's interesting about this is that it kind of suggests that our brains really have developed the optimal way of tackling this spatial awareness. And it's also really great because it means means that scientists might be able to use AI programs like this to probe the workings of that system. So, you know, they can turn maybe the grid cells on and off in a way that they wouldn't be able to do in a biological system.
All right, shifting gears here, the ongoing volcanic eruption of Mount Kilauea in Hawaii, of course, has captivated people all over the world. It has scientists working overtime to try to understand not only this eruption, but also perhaps gain insight into other future events. What are they learning so far?
So I'm sure many of your listeners are aware that the volcano has been erupting for a while now with lots of earthquakes and lava flows, forcing all those evacuations and destroying homes. But one of the good things is that Kilauea is one of the best monitored volcanoes in the world. So scientists are hoping that this huge amount of data that they're collecting will help them really better predict similar eruptions. So in this case, it's a steam explosion, which are quite difficult to predict. But there are so many instruments that are on and around that volcano. They're continuously measuring signs of geological activity, so ground movement, lava chemistry, seismic vibrations, and all that kind of thing. And there is enough data that's been produced during just this event that will keep some scientists busy for their entire careers.
Hmm. Another fabulous story about a new field of research called muography, using particles known as muons to actually try to map deep inside things like potentially actually volcanoes and other things. So let's start with the basics. What are muons?
Okay, you'll be forgiven for not knowing what a muon is because it's not widely known outside of particle physics. So what they are, you might have heard of electrons from school science classes. They're basically like a very heavy version of an electron. It's 200 times the mass and they travel close to the speed of light and they're raining down on Earth from all angles. You might remember last year there were some headlines about a previously unknown chamber being revealed within the Great Pyramid of Giza. The scientists who work on that found that with the help of muons.
Okay, so how do these muons that you say they're raining down on us all the time, but how are scientists taking advantage of them to see inside things like a pyramid or a volcano?
So what they're really good at is imaging really large, dense objects without damaging them. So if you think of it like X-rays, we use that to sort of scan some things, but X-rays can't get very far through really big things. So muons can pass through hundreds of meters of solid material before they're fully absorbed. So the denser an object is, the more energy it absorbs from the muons. So what researchers can do is they put detectors around an object, and then they can measure the energies of the muons that hit the detectors and then build up this 3D profile of an object's interior.
Is this something, I mean, it sounds incredibly useful. Is this something that's catching on in academia or even in a commercial sense?
In all kinds of places. So it's actually a field that's been worked on since the 50s, but back then the equipment was just too big, too cumbersome, too expensive. But now it's getting to the point where it's really being applied and it's kind of having its moment. So they're now being used for all kinds of things. So as well as that pyramid example that we spoke of earlier, they're being used to, say, map lava channels with inside volcanoes. In archaeology, they can be used to map, like, hidden tunnels underneath ancient settlements. And yeah, in commercial applications, there are things like a slightly adjusted version of the technology is being used to probe inside nuclear waste drums to make sure what's in there is still in there and that there aren't changes happening within the container that they're not aware of, because obviously they're very sealed and designed to be completely inaccessible. But muons are pretty much the only thing that can look inside there without damaging it.
Okay, well, last but not least, a story that I think especially going from particle physics and using muons to map shows the creativity of scientists in coming up with new tools. Some scientists are putting Antarctic seals to work to collect data for their research, hoping to improve sea level rise projections. So what are they having these seals do for them?
Absolutely. So some researchers deployed a team of 14 seals off the coast of West Antarctica in the Amundsen Sea. So that particular area is thought to be a really key player in the melt of the West Antarctic ice shelf, but it's also a region that's really difficult for us to use our traditional ship-based or mooring instruments in because of the harsh environment, and the winters can be really difficult there for researchers to work in. So they decided to recruit a team of seals.
And what have they discovered with this team of seals so far?
So the seals were adorned with sensors on their heads, and they let them loose for 9 months in the Amundsen Sea. And over that period, they swam around and they probed an area of 150,000 kilometres and they took over 10,000 measurements. So just to put that in context of what we've managed to gather before, over the previous 20 years using our traditional measurements, using our traditional instruments, they'd managed to take around 2,000 measurements. So in just 9 months, the seals managed five times that.
Pretty impressive.
Which is awesome. And it means they were able to keep going all year round. So during those really harsh conditions, when things might be changing in that patch of water that we just haven't been able to get a read on, the seals have now managed to provide that data that we can now crunch.
That's Anna Nagel. She is Chief Editor for Digital and Engagement with the journal Nature. Anna, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Residents of Cape Cod are no strangers to chemical contaminants in their drinking water. The military base here has been a Superfund site since 1989 due to jet fuel and other pollutants in the groundwater. But a new class of chemicals burst onto the scene a few years ago. They're known as perfluorinated compounds, or PFASs, and they come from things like firefighting foam, flame retardants, and nonstick coatings. They're not just showing up on Cape Cod, either. They've been found in drinking water around the country, and they've become a very hot topic in recent weeks. In May, federal EPA officials blocked the release of a report about the prevalence of these chemicals in water supplies. And then they removed or blocked reporters from a public meeting, again, about these same PFAS chemicals. Allison McCann is Water Quality Program Coordinator for University of Rhode Island's Cooperative Extension, and she co-leads community engagement efforts for a new Superfund research collaborative focused on PFASs. Allison, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Heather. It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, can you please help us break down the alphabet soup? What are PFASs and where do they come from?
PFASs are a class of substances, Heather, that are known as per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances.
Maybe we're better off with PFASs.
PFASs, yeah. And they're widely used in household products, as you had just mentioned, carpets and upholstery, waterproof clothing, waxes, nonstick cookware, grease-proof food packaging, to name a few. And, you know, in addition to those consumer products, the aqueous film-forming foams, firefighting foams, industries that produce these chemicals, waste disposal sites like landfills, wastewater treatment plants, and then areas also potentially served by septic systems.
It sounds like you could find them pretty much anywhere you turn to look for them.
Well, that's part of what we're doing with the STEEP project through our private well water testing program, is to help to discern the presence of these chemicals and potential sources of these chemicals, using Cape Cod as a laboratory, if you will, for the sources and movement of these chemicals through groundwater and surface water.
Once they're into groundwater, drinking water, bays, the ocean, whatever water sources it is, do these chemicals break down? How long do they last?
Well, they last a long time. I've seen it quoted as they're on a scale of geologic time. They're very persistent in the environment just based on their chemical makeup.
And obviously the reason that we're potentially worried about these being in our environment and not breaking down is because of possible human health concerns. How much do we know about these chemicals and their human health impacts, and how worried should we be?
Well, there's a link to these chemicals causing a variety of different health effects. Some of them include low birth weights among babies, some cancers, liver damage, thyroid problems. So there are concerns. Part of the STEEP project, and we'll be having an update on this on our Spring Science Day on June 7th, are looking at the current research and what's known about health effects.
I'm talking with Allison McCann of University of Rhode Island and the STEEP project, a new research collaborative focused on chemicals known as PFASs. These chemicals themselves are not necessarily new. We've had nonstick pans and grease-resistant coatings and firefighting foam, for that matter, for a number of years. Why has the concern and the focus on these chemicals increased so dramatically in just, you know, the past 2 or 3 years?
Well, part of it is from the EPA's unregulated contaminant monitoring rule. This particular rule was looking at what are called emerging contaminants for which there are no standards set. And PFAS is particularly PFOA and PFOS were found.
And those are different varieties of these PFASs?
That's correct. So PFOA and PFOS were tested for in the last round of the EPA's testing. And these chemicals showed up in drinking water supplies, public drinking water supplies across the country. As a result, communities across the country have become familiar with the health effects of these compounds and are asking for cleanup, are asking for standards to be set in drinking water, and are asking for actions to be taken in terms of reducing exposure.
You said this was part of a class of unregulated chemicals that are sometimes found in drinking water. Is there no EPA safety limit or guidance regarding these chemicals?
So right now there's a what's known as a health advisory level for PFOA and PFOS in drinking water, but there's no enforceable standard, and they're not listed on the EPA's list of contaminants in drinking water that need to be tested for. So the EPA regulates some 90 plus chemicals that are regularly tested for in public water supplies. And PFOA and PFOS do not have an enforceable level, contaminant level, and are not tested for on a regular basis. And that's part of what we've seen in the news lately. And the EPA has announced that they will be doing some regional meetings looking at setting standards for PFOSs. And the first meeting will be held in Portsmouth, New Hampshire in late June.
All this attention at the EPA level and all of the community concern seems to kind of run counter to what the headlines have been in the past few weeks regarding EPA. The fact that EPA is trying to not let this information get out to the public is what it seems like. Your research collaborative, the STEEP Project, is a Superfund research center, and you're specifically working on community outreach. Have you felt any pushback from above?
So just to clarify that we are funded by not EPA, but by the National Institute of Health. And the National Institute of Health, part of their program funds community engagement and interacting with the community to address contaminants of concern. And in our case, it's the PFOSs. And so they know there's been no pushback. They're highly encourage us to engage with the community in a bi-directional format, so that in addition to us doing our research and engaging with the community is engaged with us and letting us know what their concerns are, what their questions are, and how we can best help to address their needs.
With this research center, it's Harvard and University of Rhode Island and the Silent Spring Institute all working on these chemicals and, as you said, kind of focusing on Cape Cod. What is it that you're trying to learn? What more do we need to know about these chemicals?
Part of our project consists of four research projects, so one of which is looking at the movement of PFOSs through the environment, particularly in the water. We know that they're there from testing results across the country, but how do they actually move through the water, and how do we get exposed to them? Where do they come from? What are their sources? We know some of their sources, but then specifically the kinds of PFOSs that we see that coming from a wastewater treatment plant may be a different suite of compounds than we see coming from, say, a person's septic system, or from the use of firefighting foams. So where do they come from? How do they change in the environment? So not only how do they move underground and in surface waters, but how might they change? How might their chemical composition change as they move? And looking at chemical properties that make them unique, and doing some work both in the lab on rodents, and then also work being done collecting blood samples and work being done with human subjects in terms of exposure to PFASs. And all of these items, the research updates will be part of our June 7th event. And it's a whole day event at the Barnstable Town Hall, and we welcome folks to come for any or all portions of the day that they can come.
Allison McCann is Water Quality Program Coordinator for University of Rhode Island's Cooperative Extension, and she co-leads community engagement efforts for a new Superfund research collaborative called STEEP. Allison, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
After the break, it's artificial meat and the farm bill. Stay with us.